let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, like maybe some music. There is a fantastic musician here in the studio. I've had his CD. I don't even know how long I've had the CD, but I've enjoyed it, and so I'm excited to have him on the show today. From the Crooked Jades, I'd like to welcome Jeff Kayser. Hello.
I'm excited to be here, Marilyn.
So tell me a little bit about the Crooked Jades. Like how long have you guys been around? Whose brainchild was it?
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm here to celebrate our 30th anniversary.
What?
Yes.
Wow. Wait. 30?
30 years.
Okay.
1994.
Wow.
It was our first official gig and here in San Francisco. And I wish I could remember what that was.
It doesn't matter.
Too long ago.
Yeah. So, like, what was it? It's like, hey, let's form a band. Or, like, how did it come about?
It came about with me meeting Lisa Berman, who is the co-founder. And we met at an old-time camp in Puget Sound. And it's a camp that you just study old-time music.
Mm-hmm.
Music from the 1920s. Mostly based in Appalachia.
Oh, okay.
And banjos, mandolin. Lisa plays Hawaiian slide and dobro. And we started playing music together.
Uh-huh.
And we noticed that we have this natural harmony ability that sounds pretty cool.
So, okay. And you guys were what, like 10 at the time?
Yes, we were. we weren't even teenagers. We started to go to jams, old-time jams, bluegrass jams.
Yeah.
And we started finding other musicians that wanted to play the music that we wanted to.
Okay.
And we formed a band finally in 1994.
Wow. Yeah. So, like, has it been the same musicians the whole time?
Pretty much. Lisa and I have been the constant. Eric Pearson, is another funny story. he is a longtime member. He joined about a year later after that.
Uh-huh.
But he was just playing rock guitar. And we heard the secret that he plays clawhammer banjo.
Ooh. What's the difference between a clawhammer banjo and any other banjo?
Well, a bluegrass banjo, you use finger picks, and it's pretty much staccato. Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
But clawhammer banjo is more of a frailing bump, diddy, bump, diddy, bump. It's more like a babbling brook. And it's got this really soft feeling, and that style comes from West Africa.
Okay. Then I know what you're talking about.
Right. As well as the banjo, that type of banjo.
Mm-hmm.
We found out that he was playing at the Hotel Utah, I think that was in 95.
Okay.
And we came up to you and we heard you play clawhammer banjo. This is a big secret. So it was great. He joined the group.
Uh-huh.
And from then on, we had several other players. Stephanie Prousnitz played fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
We had Tom Lucas also playing fiddle and banjo. And it's been, so far, the core, Eric, Lisa, and I have survived this long.
Very
in the 30,
nice.
30
that's,
years.
That's impressive, you know.
It is.
Because bands usually have a shelf life of like 5 years. And
oh,
then there's creative differences.
So, right, you know. Right. Lots of therapy sessions. That's how
sure.
we made it through.
So you talked about your roots doing the sort of the music based out of Appalachia.
Yeah.
So is that your main focus, or have you expanded outside of that?
thank you for asking that question. Absolutely. Our base is in old-time string band music,
mm-hmm.
and but we've been evolving. We keep moving forward, and I mean, I have to say, we're playing right now some covers from 80s music.
Like?
In our timeline,
uh-huh.
our soundtracks.
For example,
Devo.
Oh, cool.
Depeche Mode.
Okay.
There's been, I'm trying to think. Oh, The Cure is a little bit more of a goth
mm-hmm.
feeling to it. And mm-hmm. it's almost like we're comparing the 1880s to the 1980s.
Okay.
So there's this strange, and this is what will bring forth our 10th final, well, not final, I hope not, 10th album project.
Or most recent.
Most recent, yeah. And we're about to... launch a crowdfunding on that one.
Now, what's the name of this most recent project?
I don't know.
You don't have a working title for your next CD?
We don't have a working title. We're just about to launch the campaign for crowdfunding. But we have been playing these songs for the last couple of years
mm-hmm.
at our shows, and we can't wait to record them.
Oh, okay.
Because it's we're recording these goth songs. There's one by Tones on Tail called Go,
mm-hmm.
and it has such a positive message in it. But when you hear it at the clubs
mm-hmm.
during the late 70s and early 80s, it was very dark.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's not until you really can hear the lyrics that it has such a positive outlook on life.
Well, there's a lot of music that does that. Like they usually do like the super cheerful music that it turns out is like someone dies in it.
Right.
You know,
right.
And you're just like, this song is banging.
Yeah.
And you have the opposite problem.
The opposite. Yeah. And we're going to put these through our old time filter.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see so we're really excited about giving these all these songs on all these, on a banjo and a mm-hmm. fiddle and a guitar and slide guitar. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit, like, how difficult is it to find people who actually play banjo?
Wow.
Or and slide guitar.
Yeah.
And fiddle.
And fiddle. It's surprisingly, amazingly, when we were... back in 94,
uh-huh.
San Francisco especially, I was really at a low point in the sense of having venues, community. There isn't too much bluegrass and old-time music happening. There was a place called Paul's Saloon that mm-hmm. had closed in the late 80s.
Okay.
And then after that, it was kind of a desert.
Okay.
In a sense. So... It started picking up in the mid-90s,
mm-hmm.
and now I just feel like everyone's getting turned on to the banjo.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very, I have to say, popular.
What about the fiddle?
And the fiddle, too.
Because the fiddle is just, it's just like the... it's what they call it when you're not too high-toned enough to call it a violin.
That's right. What's the difference between a violin and a fiddle?
Like $100,000, basically. It's the salary.
So there, I have to say, we just recently found an amazing fiddler. It was tough. It's low inventory here, and there is quite a few, but they're all in like three or four bands.
Of course.
Yes.
And they're all like the bluegrass,
all snapped up. But I feel the scene, I think it's pretty healthy here mm-hmm. in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And I'm excited about that.
Well, I'm just going to say, for all you musicians out there who are trying to find a band, maybe if you learned to play the fiddle, you'd be in high demand. That's all there is to it.
You'd be in major demand.
So tell our listening audience what brings you here today.
Well, what brings me here today, obviously, is our celebration of our 30th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
But we are doing a hometown show.
Ooh.
Yes. And this is super exciting.
You don't you don't count Puget Sound as like your hometown origin story. It's San Francisco.
It's our founding connection is okay. Puget Sound, but all of us lived here in the city.
Okay.
And Lisa and Eric have moved to the East Bay,
mm-hmm.
and but I'm still here in San Francisco, still hanging in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have our 30th anniversary celebration multimedia.
Ooh.
Extravaganza.
Okay.
At the Four Star Theater.
Where's the Four Star Theater?
On Friday the 16th.
Uh-huh.
This week, the Four Star Theater is on Clement Street. And that theater was founded and built in 1916.
Okay.
So at the peak of old-time music. That okay. was happening.
I'm trying to visualize, like, where is it, like, around 12th? Where is the...
It is on Clement and 23rd Street.
Oh, okay. It's way down there. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I didn't even know that, these smaller theaters, because they're closing left, right, and sideways, so it's exciting to hear that that one's still open.
Well, it was due to... Adam Bergeron, he actually saved the Vogue, the Balboa,
mm-hmm.
and the Four Star.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. So you're doing your big shindig there.
Yes, we're doing our big show there, and we're going to. We just finished this last night, but we've been going through archival footage of mm-hmm. San Francisco
mm-hmm.
from 1906. To 1955.
Ah.
And there's been a lot of forgotten things, great landmarks here, including Playland and a sky train that went from the... I'm giving it all away. Spoiler alert.
Okay. Everyone, plug your ears yeah. while we talk.
The sky train that went from the Cliff House uh-huh. out to the sea. but that, yeah, that was back in the, I guess, in the 40s. So we're going to be projecting all this footage and while we're playing songs.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be in the background. But I also want to say that we have an amazing special guest that's with us. His name is Bruce Caffin.
Mm-hmm.
He's an amazing instrumentalist. He's a virtuoso pedal steel player.
Ooh.
And he has played with amazing sessions with John Lee Hooker.
Wow.
R.E.M., Sheryl Crow, Black Crowes. And he was in the band American Music Club for quite a while. And he toured with David Byrne for years.
Yeah, so he's got a pedigree.
Absolutely. So I am just so excited that he's going to be playing with us on Friday night.
So that's this Friday.
It's this Friday.
What time do doors open?
The doors open at 7 and the show's at 8.
And where can people pick up tickets in advance?
You can pick up tickets at crookedjades.com.
Mm-hmm. And can people also walk up and get tickets?
Absolutely.
Excellent, excellent.
Yes.
And so if people want to know more about the Crooked Jades and follow your event, what you plan to do and all of that stuff, how do they go about doing that?
Well, you can go to our website, crookedjades.com. We also we have Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Instagram is heavily populated, and our Facebook as well.
Okay. So. And then I just remembered the question that I had wanted to ask you before, which is what are your favorite musical inspirations?
Oh my God.
So that people can go, I think I'll go listen to this.
I like to say I'm a professional musician, but honestly, what keeps me afloat here in San Francisco, I'm a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
I DJ over at the Makeout Room.
Oh, okay.
Every first and fourth Friday. And
what's your DJ moniker?
My DJ moniker is DJ Too Shy to Shy.
Okay.
It's such a tough one for me because we spin a lot of international disco, a lot of folk, international stuff, and so much funk and soul and hip hop, and it just I'm just trying to think what I'm recently been listening to.
Yeah, who inspires you at this moment?
At this moment, let me see. I've been listening to a lot of Cricket Jazz.
Well, there you go. There you have it. You heard it here first, folks. Cricket Jazz inspires Cricket Jazz.
I was just trying to remember this name of this one disco. But yeah.
It'll come to you.
It'll come.
Yeah. So once more for our listening audience, when and what time for the Cricket Jade's 30th anniversary of jam session?
Absolutely. Yes, it's going to be Friday the 16th. That's this Friday at the Four Star Theater, which is on Clement Street, and the Cross is 23rd. And the doors open at 7 p.m. and we get going at 8.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you, Jeff Kazor, for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, Marilyn.
People of Earth, this is your opportunity to check out the Cricket Jades. And in case you were wondering what they sounded like, I'm going to let you listen to some right now from Empathy Moves the Water.
There's a tiny piece to remind. Way before hashtags were people, we are the humankind. Where everybody hurts, where everybody hurts, where everybody bleeds, where everybody bleeds, where everybody loves, everybody hates. So in all the seas, empathy moves the water. Love. Shot out the light. Everybody run for cover. Yeah, well, everybody hold on tight. Empathy moves the water. Love in the light. Come with me, my brother, and walk in your eyes tonight. In your eyes.
Here we go.
All right. Great again, yeah, oh, hey.
That's Empathy Moves the Water by the Crooked Jades. You'll be able to check them out on Friday when they do their big 30-year shindig. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Well, I have a gentleman on the line here who is going to be telling you about democracy. Speaking about democracy, I'd like to welcome Gary Lux. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Marilyn.
How's it going?
Very well, thank you.
So tell me a little bit about the group that you work with.
Yeah, so we started Parties for Democracy in the 2020 election, and we had worked for about 6 months putting together a fundraiser with Bonnie Raitt and David Crosby, and after 6 months of planning, COVID intervened, and we had to scrap the effort.
So we morphed
it into Zoom parties, where we raised about $450,000 in 3 months on the fly with remote Zoom calls, which was a model that worked pretty darn well. And now we're in the midst of doing the same for the 2024 election with this program called Parties for Democracy.
Okay, and what is the platform for Parties for Democracy, or your mission statement?
Yeah, the idea is we've curated a lot of NGO organizations that are focused on getting out the vote and so on. And for example, we just did an event on Friday, actually, which was celebrating my birthday. What we do is we try to encourage friends who have their network of people who care about holding on to our democracy. And so essentially each host invites their friends either for a birthday, half birthday, or anniversary or some theme, or just democracy as the theme. And so my birthday is this month, so I invited a couple hundred friends by email, and we'd raised about $15,000 in 45 minutes.
Wow.
Focusing on the curated organizations, like I promoted Headcount, for example. Headcount is an organization that was started by, I think, Bobby Weir and some other musicians after the 2020 election. Mm-hmm. And they're focused, nonpartisan, they're focused on registering voters at concerts. And so this year they're on track to register for 520,000 voters, mostly Gen Z and young millennials. Mm-hmm. And so I promoted them. I promoted another organization called Activate America. And so people just donated to the QR codes that we had. And we just make it easy for people. And essentially, everyone gets inundated with these texts and emails for candidates. And our goal is to encourage our friends to unsubscribe and focus on the curated organizations that we're promoting through these Parties for Democracy.
Now, I read that you also co-founded the Sustainable Earth Initiative. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's unrelated to getting the vote out, but
sure.
That's a sustainability organization. I'm an environmental lawyer, and my focus is not just on the law, but also on sustainability, where you can shrink ecological footprints for companies and organizations by like lowering their energy footprint, their carbon footprint, their material or water usage. And so the Sustainable Earth Initiative was an NGO that my colleague and I co-founded to work with organizations to dissect and look at all components of an organization and find ways to shrink the footprint. So we work with airports and water agencies and other organizations to do that very thing. And so that's what the Sustainable Earth Initiative was focused on.
Okay. That's very cool. Now we're going to go back to you registering people to vote. What are some of the roadblocks to being registered to vote, and how do you address those things?
Well, certainly, we're promoting Headcount because, they register voters at concerts. They have like 3,000 events And so one thing that they do is they have volunteers to check with voters to see if they, because a lot of young voters are college students, right? Mm-hmm. And they end up moving and they don't know whether they've re-registered in their new address.
Oh.
So at the headcount concerts, they actually can quickly determine whether the college student or young person has re-registered. So that's one way that they help manage that in addition to registering them. One note of interest is that they say that 78% of those they registered in 2020 mm-hmm. Voted. So it's a much higher rate of voting than most demographics as well.
I like that because I find that you'll hear people say, oh, it doesn't matter, it's all rigged anyway, and people don't want to vote. But, you know, the fact that the younger people are taking it really seriously, that gives me a lot of I find that very encouraging.
Well, and it belies the standard the typical data with most demographics. So yeah, it may have something to do with just the way headcount manages and promotes the effort. So there's somewhat of an outlier, I think, mm-hmm. but I think that organization's amazing, and they're on track to register 520,000 voters this this year.
And are they local? Are they national?
They're national. They're the second largest voter registration organization in the U.S.
Wow.
And so they're one of the organizations that we support. We support other organizations like Commit to Democracy, Focus for Democracy, Vote Forward, Activate America, Reclaim Our Vote, Swing Left, and many others. So, you know, again, we've curated a list, and we have a website, which is partiesfordemocracy.net,
mm-hmm.
partiesfordemocracy.net, which curates all the organizations that we've vetted that we know move the needle the furthest and the quickest.
Okay. So I understand you have an event coming up tomorrow, I believe?
Yeah, tomorrow we have one in Pennsylvania. So it's a 2 p.m. Zoom call, which would be 5 o'clock our time.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's in the East Coast, it's Pennsylvania, of course.
Sure.
And you know, if anyone wants to learn about that, they can email me at gary@beyondcompliance.net. That's Gary with one R at beyondcompliance.net for 2 p.m. California time on Tuesday.
Excellent. And I see on your Parties for Democracy, you have a how to host your party for democracy. Now, what is that?
Yeah. So on our website, partiesfordemocracy.net, we have a couple of short videos that identify basically a mini toolkit on how anyone could host their own party.
Okay.
And it's basically what we call a very light lift for a big payoff. So a couple of hours at most to assemble your email list of friends and family across the country to do a Zoom or remote call in 45 minutes, ultimately. And on average, the parties raise about $10,000.
Wow.
It depends on the network of people. But, you know, I raised $15K almost in 45 minutes with others that didn't attend, so we can maybe even clear the $20,000 mark. So we have this whole curated effort in partiesfordemocracy.net on our website, and anyone could do a party. We have volunteers and wranglers who could work with anyone who wants to host a party. And again, it's only a few hours of effort for a big payoff in terms of effort versus, you know, raising money for what matters for our democracy.
Okay. And then just as out of curiosity for you, when you run across people who don't vote or, don't think it's worth it, how do you gently or what are your talking points to get them to consider voting?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm for better or for worse, I've been working on campaigns my whole life and every 2 years. And you walk precincts and you realize, there have been so many close elections. Even the 1960 election was decided by 100,000 votes, which was an average of one vote per precinct.
Wow.
And so the outcome could be dramatically different. And you look at the 2020 the year 2000 election, where, you know, depending on how you view the outcome, the 537 votes in Florida made all the difference mm-hmm. between Al Gore versus George W. Bush. So, and there's so many other stories of a handful of votes that, you know, decided election one way or another. So, unfortunately, we don't, unlike some countries where voting is mandatory, it's optional here, and we have relatively low turnout. And with that, even small margins make a difference.
Okay. That's
that's what I tell people.
That is a compelling argument. So for our listening audience, if people want to find out more about your organization, how do they go about doing that?
Well, let's see. So they could email me at gary@beyondcompliance.net. And that's probably the best way, I think, or go to the link I mentioned, partiesfordemocracy.net, and I'd be more than happy to have our volunteers work with anyone who's interested in hosting a Party for Democracy.
Excellent. Is there anything else you'd like our listening audience to know?
I don't think so. I just thank you for the opportunity for sharing.
Well, thank you for, you know, going out there and, you know, trying to mobilize the vote, because I do think that voting is important, you know, on either side. You need to make your voice heard.
Yeah, well, it helps me sleep at night, so that's why I do it.
All right, well,
thank you.
Gary Lux, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Take care. Thank you.
All right. People of Earth, vote. That's all I ask. Just vote. You know, if you don't vote, you can't complain. And if voting weren't important, they wouldn't spend so much time and effort trying to talk you out of voting and trying to convince you that your vote isn't important. It's very important. So vote, okay? Okay.
for my mind. Thank you for my food. But you kept me. You didn't have to hear my mourning. You didn't have to hear my groaning. Hey, hey, hey. But Lord, you blessed me. And Lord, I want to thank you. I just got to say much obliged to you, Master. Cause the walls of my room was not the walls of my grave. My bed was not my cooling board. Y'all don't know what I'm talking about. My sheet was not my wine.
My wine and sheet.
And I was sent by
That's Donny Hathaway. Thank you, Master, for my soul. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Well, there's a show happening at the Marsh Berkeley. It is called 100 Days to Die to Live. Here to talk about that show, I'd like to welcome writer, performer, curator, Stephanie Weissman. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm good. I'm getting ready to go to my first rehearsal for the play.
Congrats. So it's a very heavy topic, but it sounds like you have found the lightness within it.
One can only hope.
One can only hope. So why don't you tell our listening audience a little bit about this play?
Just about the play, is that what you said? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Well, it's about 180 days or 6 months, mm-hmm. Titled To Die to Live. And it's about the end-of-life assisted suicide option. Very comedic, huh? And it's about my husband, who died of pancreatic cancer, and a friend who was actually the first volunteer at the Marsh back in 1989. She took tickets for our first performance. And I found out that she was also dying of it because she gave a donation to the Marsh because of the impact that it had on her life. And mm-hmm. That's how I found out. And so this play is about end-of-life choices and how do we live when we are dying, when we actually have that opportunity to know we have some months left. And Stephanie, is the narrator who's, mm-hmm. Between these things and the caretaker, so to speak, of my husband and not of Shelley, of course. But how do you stay alive during these kind of desperate and sorrowful times?
So did these two diagnoses happen close to one another, or were they far apart enough that you, because it sounds like a sucker punch if you get them both, like one boom, boom, right after the other?
Yes, they were about, my husband was diagnosed in June, and Shelley was diagnosed in October.
That's like right on top of one another. That's devastating. How do you, as the person who hears this, how do you navigate it? Because it's happening to someone else, but also to you.
Yes. So one big aspect of the play is the caretaker's does Qigong. One of the methods of trying to navigate and trying to stay alive, surrounded by all this death, in a sense.
What is Qigong?
Qigong is like a different form of Tai Chi.
Okay.
So it's very slow. It's meditative movement that's very focused on health aspects.
Is that the thing that we will see, like the Chinese grandmothers doing in the park?
I think that's Tai Chi.
Okay.
They might be doing Qigong, but I think what we normally think of is in the park is the Tai Chi form.
Okay.
But it's not that different, right? It's a slow moving, you know, beautiful kind of movement that, you know, help to set a meditative aspect to your life. I mean, for me, it's impossible for me to meditate. But when I do Qigong, you know, it gets me there. Really gets me there. So the piece incorporates that into it.
So how did you get introduced to Qigong? And like was it in concert with hearing your husband's diagnosis? Or
It was actually because of the marsh. During COVID, I've been, because I also had cancer. Ugh. So I've, you know, worked really hard to try to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I've done is Tibetan herbs. The Tibetan herbs doctor's manager teaches Qigong. Mm-hmm. And when we started doing all those marsh streams during the shuttering of COVID, I did a Qigong marsh stream. We did a whole series of lessons. So that was my first introduction to it. And since then, I've kept it up. And in fact, the amazing thing is I am now certified as a Radiant Lotus Women's Qigong teacher.
Very cool. Very cool. So you do this Qigong. Is your husband also doing it, or is that just not a possibility?
He wasn't doing it. First of all, I don't think he would have ever done it.
Okay.
Or a football, baseball, tennis, mountain biker type of guy.
Okay.
But by the time I started it, he wasn't doing it during COVID. And, well, a lot of this actually took place during COVID. But,
All right.
My husband, Richard, was not a Qigonger.
Well, then let's talk about first Richard's journey, because you say, you know, he's basically given 6 months, and then we'll talk about Shelley's. But let's start with your husband. So what did that look like, and how do you address it in the show?
So my husband, by the time he was diagnosed, it had metastasized everywhere.
Okay.
So he, you know, first of all, pancreatic cancer, the survival rate is so very low. And on top of it, it had metastasized. So he did not have a lot of time left once he was diagnosed. And he chose to do chemotherapy treatment. And mm-hmm. he did 7 rounds of chemo, which is, you know, mm-hmm. tough. But he did that because he wanted to extend his life to be able to finish up certain things in his life. And so he spent those last months when he was able, you know, just, you know, doing things that, you know, he got the sewer fixed at our house. Yeah.
Oh, that's why you want to extend your life.
All these important things, right?
Yeah, I got some chores to do, so I choose to do all of this. Okay.
Right. He was trying to make my life be as safe as he could.
Sure.
And take care of the details as much as he could, particularly the things that he knew that would impact me.
Mm-hmm. So even in his terminal state, he was thinking about what can I do so that even when I'm gone, everything just runs smoothly.
Yes, he did a lot.
Okay,
he did not get rid of his 50,000 tools, I will say, but he did as much as he could.
Okay. Well, all you have to do is put those on, like, buy nothing, and they'll all disappear. But so your husband did the chemo, and Shelley, from what I understand, did not?
Yes. Shelley chose no treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she knew that many people in her family had died of cancer,
mm.
and she had watched how awful she thought that the treatment was, how devastating it was. And when she was diagnosed, it had not metastasized yet. So she, you know, did have more time than Richard would have had.
Mm-hmm.
And she also, based on her past medical history, she was a therapist. She knew how to deal with, she had learned how to deal with pain. And
okay.
So she had a very, you know, very specific way that she ended her life and paid attention to every detail, including the fact that she was a therapist and she had to tell all her clients, her therapy clients, that she all of a sudden was no longer going to be their therapist. And and she's quite brilliant, as was my husband, I might add. And she did a series of videotaped interviews with people at the UCSF, and talking, you know, in some extent talking about how you deal with these therapy patients in this situation, and how there isn't a lot of information on what to do. So in a way, she kind of set up a little bit of a structure and a model for that. And she got her 5,000 books. They were, you know, given to big libraries, and she just really, and we got to meet, and that's the fun thing where she, the first, one of the things that she had, her first donation to the Marsh was when we made these crazy plaster Paris feet and toes to raise money way back when.
Okay.
She returned her toe to me.
Do you still have her toe?
It's going to be in the play.
Oh.
Her not her actual toe, her plaster Paris toe.
I understood that. I did.
But I want to make sure the people listening understand that.
Sure. Okay, so you have these two people, and both of them opt for the assisted suicide option. And
yes.
As a therapist, does she tell her patients that that's what's going to happen, or does she just sort of leave it at, I'm no longer going to, you know, be doing therapy?
I don't actually know. I have a feeling she didn't tell her patients that, but I don't know that. I didn't ask her that.
All right. So for when you first hear, when you first are discussing the suicide option, how does it come up, and how do you react to that when your husband says, you know what, I think I want to take matters into my own hands?
My husband was actually a competitive shooter.
Okay.
So I had to take this. I knew it was no idle threat. And luckily, my sister is a bioethicist, and she told us about the end-of-life option. You know, so we quickly moved from how we quickly got to how we could do it in, you know, the most humane way possible.
So you're saying that initially he was saying, I'm going to shoot myself, and it was your sister who said there's a kinder way to do that.
Right. So can you imagine? So, you know, what you can't imagine the relief initially of that, even though it was such a horrifying, you know, thought, because
right.
It still is death, you
yes.
know? And so, you know, so it became, you know, like when and how and how, and that's what the play's about is, you know, in a sense, if you choose to do something like that, that we are extremely lucky that in California, it's legal. And it's only been legal since 2016. And I think most people don't even know it's legal. So in some aspects, this play is also an advocacy thing, that if people want to choose to do that, they can do it here. And that they, it's important that people know that they have this option.
Okay. So your husband, he opts for that option. Then your friend also opts for, is it the same, does it happen the same way? Or I guess what I'm asking is, is the method the same? Is it like a lethal injection, or what? What is that?
It's generally the same. I think Shelley ended up choosing a slightly different option because at the time that she decided it was time, I think she was concerned about not being able to keep it down.
Mm.
And so that she did a slightly different thing, but basically it's the same.
Okay. Okay. And for you knowing that it's going to happen, how do you prepare yourself for the day that you know that this is it for my husband?
You know, it's so, I'm sure you can imagine how difficult that is.
Yes. Because is it happening at home? Is it happening in a controlled setting elsewhere?
So the way it happens is that we set it up. He died at the end of December.
Okay.
And we set it up in October. This is one of the first. He was very adamant that he was going to do this. And we were currently, he was getting his health care from Kaiser. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, there's a very specific trajectory and timeline you go through because you have to make sure that the person is competent. They are very much making sure that the person is competent to make the decision.
Sure.
So there's a series of social workers and doctors you have to meet with before they sign off on it. And then once they sign off on it, then it's a pharmacy thing, right? They send mm-hmm. it to you from the pharmacy. Because it's a series of drugs that you take. So how do I feel? It's like, You feel, I feel very sad and sorrowful and also very protective of him that to make sure that he would actually get to make that choice.
Got it.
So we worked together on that. I went to all the meetings. They were on Zoom because I think it was during the shuttering. Mm-hmm. So we met with the doctors and the social workers and the pharmacist finally. And, I don't know what more else to say is, it's like when does, and that's a little bit about what the play is about. When did Richard decide, what did it come down to making him decide that it was time?
Understood. So the show is called About 180 Days to Die to Live. That is happening at the Marsh Berkeley Friday, August 27th, Saturday, August 24th, and Sunday, August 25th. If people want to learn more about the show, how do they go about doing that?
You can go to our website, themarsh.org, and click on either the In Front of Your Eyes Women's Performance Festival or click directly on 180 Days.
All right. Well, Stephanie Weissman, number one, I'm sorry for your loss, but I am glad that the people in your life were able to go out the way they chose to. So, and I hope that this show is a success.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me part of this interview.
You're welcome. All right, people of Earth, About 180 Days to Die to Live. That's happening at the Marsh in Berkeley. It's just about time for me to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodle-doo.
Voice foretold where I shall die. Where my soul shall rest, and my body lies where pain.